It's time now for a rundown of the prepared portion of tonight's program. I'm going to tell you what, basically, you're going to be hearing. Now, again, as I said in my introduction, this is going to be a somewhat different program from what I have done in the past. I am going to be touching on some news articles. I'm also going to be playing a tape and philosophizing to a certain extent. For the benefit of those who eventually hear this program on tape, today is July 5th, 1992, one day after the United States has observed its 216th birthday. And what I'm going to be doing is reflecting on the country, what's wrong with it. In particular, I'm going to be focusing on the Kennedy assassination, the John Kennedy assassination, that is. And I'm also going to be taking a look at what I consider to be some destructive intellectual attitudes on the part of a great many people, including large segments of the progressive political community, and why I feel that destructive intellectual attitude has contributed materially to the sorry, sorry state of the United States in calendar year 1992. I'm going to begin by rereading a section of something which I reread frequently. That's a section from the book They Thought They Were Free, subtitled The Germans 1933 to 1945. I'm going to be reading a short section about a college professor who lived through the rise of Nazism, was opposed to Nazism, but basically did nothing. And that's going to be our jumping off point, and I want to ask the indulgence of those of you who have heard this before. I reread part of it last week. But the thing that I'm going to be stressing is how the conformity of the German people contributed to the rise of Hitler, because I'm afraid that that conformity on the part of the American people is a major contributing factor to the rise of American fascism, and unfortunately this country is going fascist at an enormous pace. By way of taking a look at what happened to the Germans so that hopefully we can avoid what happened to them, again, I will be rereading They Thought They Were Free. After that, we're going to take a look at, not take a look, actually take a listen to one of my personal role models, and that, again, is the famous playwright George Bernard Shaw, who, by the way, was very, very active against fascism. People ask me to describe my own political philosophy or how would I characterize myself. I refer to myself as an anti-fascist, and George Bernard Shaw was very much that. He was also a very wise and very witty individual. And we're going to be listening to George Bernard Shaw's ruminations on the occasion of his 80th birthday. He recorded a record, and among the observations he had was a hypothetical discussion that he had with some students in the sixth form, very much younger than himself. And Shaw had a number of observations about life, about the nature of education, about society, social commitment, intellectual conformity, and I think we can draw much from George Bernard Shaw's wisdom today. This particular tape is, by the way, about as close to what I would consider to be my personal credo as anything you're ever going to come across. So perhaps this tape could also be subtitled Dave Emery's Credo. I try to live up to the very important principles set forth by George Bernard Shaw, so far imperfectly indeed. He was a very wise man. And looking back from almost twice my present age, I'll be 43 in September, God willing and the crick don't rise, George Bernard Shaw was looking back from the age of 80, and I take his observations to be a challenge of a lifetime, basically. Not easy to live up to, but necessary nonetheless. So we're going to begin, really the meat of the discussion, by listening to George Bernard Shaw and some of his observations on a variety of things. After that, I'm going to read a section of a letter to a listener. And by the way, the listener is a very supportive listener, and I obtained his permission to read a section of the letter. This is a letter from one of America's leading intellectuals and an individual that I also have been quite critical of, namely Professor Noam Chomsky of the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. Chomsky has certainly done a great deal of good work. I would not deny that, but I also think that he is taken some very, very destructive intellectual stances, and I'm going to take a look at some things that he wrote to a friend and professional colleague who shared this letter with me about the Kennedy assassination, and I will delineate in no uncertain terms what I think is destructive. And by the way, I do not mean to single out Noam Chomsky, rather to use Professor Chomsky's errant observations about President Kennedy's presidency and assassination to illustrate a wider principle of intellectual culture. I believe and have believed for a long time that intellectual culture is by its very nature reactionary, when people have grown accustomed to thinking of something as true, when you present them with evidence that it is not, in fact, true, they tend to resist it. There's an old Chinese proverb that you can't teach a pig to sing, and if you try, you'll annoy him. Unfortunately, that is true of an awful lot of people. And again, I do not want to single out my criticisms of Noam Chomsky. I do not mean to single him out, but rather to use the errant observations of this very brilliant individual to illustrate a wider principle of intellectual culture and to illustrate also what I think is very destructive about aspects of American intellectual culture. And I believe that particular destructive aspect has, to a large extent, brought us to the state we're in. Chomsky, and I will read this section of the letter, pooh-poohs the notion that there was anything behind. There were no forces, political forces, that would have assassinated President Kennedy, and says that basically he doesn't even intend to examine the assassination itself because it's like arguing with religious fanatics. And I think that Noam Chomsky's criticism of assassination researchers or people that delve into the national security establishment, and my particular field of expertise and research is the U.S. national security establishment and fascism. By national security establishment, I mean the military and intelligence community, and to dismiss those of us who have done responsible research over the years as religious fanatics does, I think, not only a disservice to us, but frankly a disservice to the country. And I will be offering up some strong but constructive criticism of this particular intellectual stance during the course of the program. We're then going to take a look at the Kennedy assassination itself. I have done many programs about the Kennedy assassination. Just last week, I added to the Guns of November Part 3, dealing with connections between the Kennedy assassination and Watergate, and also one of the main motivational factors behind Kennedy's assassination, and namely his attempts to withdraw the United States from Vietnam, something which Noam Chomsky denies, and I'll be talking about that later. We're going to begin taking a look at various aspects of the Kennedy assassination. I'm going to sort of skip around randomly because the body of information on Kennedy's assassination is so massive, and that's one of the things that I think is unfortunate about the stance that Professor Chomsky has taken. The evidence, not only that there was a conspiracy, but specifically that fascist elements of our national security establishment and business establishment came into ascendancy on 11-22-63. Well, that body of information is massive at this point, and unfortunately, the American people have not looked at that particular body of information. The Oliver Stone movie JFK has awakened a great deal of interest, at least to a certain extent, relatively speaking, I should say, into the Kennedy assassination. That's a good thing. But I would note that Oliver Stone, like all people who have departed from the intellectual norm, not just in this society, but in society since the dawn of civilization, well, Freudian slip, Oliver Stone has been pilloried and marginalized, and indeed New Orleans District Attorney Jim Garrison has been pilloried and marginalized, not just by the mainstream and reactionary press, but also by the progressive political community as well, and I'm going to be putting a few well-aimed barbs into the progressive political community and some of its spokespersons this evening by way of constructive criticism. Again, this should not be interpreted as a personal indictment, although in a couple of cases, such as Ramsey Clark and Jesse Jackson, it is a personal indictment because their behavior is extremely suspicious, and I will go into that later. I'm going to be taking a look, reviewing a piece of information which came out in the news recently, which is that two of the X-ray technicians who were involved in X-raying President Kennedy's body have stated that the X-rays released to the general public were faked. And after that, I'm going to take a look at the, quote, suicide, unquote, of Lieutenant Pitzer, who was the autopsy photographer in Kennedy's assassination. One of the things that is destructive about poo-pooing the Kennedy assassination, poo-pooing the people who researched it, and poo-pooing our other political assassinations is not only that we become unaware of our own political history because of that, but also because these situations are not abstract intellectual, it's not an abstract intellectual exercise. Real people have suffered greatly. Many of them have been killed. Many of them have been destroyed professionally. And there has been an awful lot of grievous personal damage that has gone down as a result of the Kennedy assassination and the American people's failure to take into account what it meant, the forces that were behind it. And we're going to take a look at the death of the unfortunate Lieutenant Pitzer, a supposed suicide, but there are questions about it. We're going to be looking at The work of Penn Jones, a Texas researcher, a reporter with the Midlothian Mirror, that's M-I-D-L-O-T-H-I-A-N. Penn Jones' landmark works, Forgive My Grief, Volumes 1 through 4, are among the many works that have been tragically overlooked by the general public and also the progressive political community as well. We're going to take a look at the deaths of a number of people that were connected with the assassination. One of the things that's tragic about poo-pooing this field of research is that there have been so many deaths, either obvious murders of people who were involved or witnessed the assassinations, but also the deaths of people who may have been involved. What Penn Jones has been instrumental in chronicling the very suspicious deaths of people in some way involved with the investigation, and we're going to be taking a look at several of those deaths, including several deaths which helped to frustrate Jim Garrison's investigation in New Orleans. The House Select Committee on Assassinations in 1979, the Select Committee on Assassinations again in 1979 returned a verdict that it said a 95% probability of a conspiracy behind President Kennedy's assassination. Well, it's not 95%, it's 100%. And interestingly enough, one of the people at the House Select Committee on Assassinations, even though its investigation was badly compromised, they said that the U.S. Department of Justice should begin investigating David Ferry and the anti-Castro Cubans in New Orleans. Well, David Ferry was who Jim Garrison was after, and that was his ultimate vindication. The only disappointing thing I found in the Stone film was that at the very end they did not mention that the House Select Committee on Assassinations recommended that the DOJ begin investigating David Ferry. That was Garrison's ultimate vindication. We're going to take a look at the deaths of several people connected with Garrison's investigation and how that helped to frustrate Garrison's investigation into the Kennedy assassination. We're also going to take a look at a darling of the progressive political community, namely former Attorney General Ramsey Clark. He is, as I said, something of a cause célèbre in progressive political circles, and yet he was the Attorney General who helped frustrate Jim Garrison's investigation by giving misleading information in press conferences and also withholding critical documents that Garrison had requested for his investigation. It was also Ramsey Clark who failed to pursue the assassinations of Martin Luther King and John Kennedy, and indeed Clark announced that there was no conspiracy behind the assassination of Martin Luther King long before any serious investigation could have been covered up. And it is unfortunate, in my opinion, that the backgrounds of people like Ramsey Clark have not been scrutinized, and unfortunately I think far too many people have fallen into the habit of taking the words of someone whose behavior implicates him to a certain extent in the cover-up of the Kennedy assassination, and Ramsey Clark's does, as well as people like Noam Chomsky, certainly not involved in the Kennedy assassination or its cover-up, but yet an individual who has helped to, in my opinion, assassinate the truth concerning this country's political realities. We're going to take a look at, again, several people who were involved in Jim Garrison's investigation. And in addition to looking at, we're also going to take a look at some of the many, many firm indications of conspiracy on the part of the National Security Establishment to cover up President Kennedy's assassination. We're going to take a look at how telephone company employees were turned away when they produced solid evidence from phone company records that, in fact, Lee Harvey Oswald and Jack Ruby knew each other. The FBI didn't want to hear about it. The Warren Commission didn't want to hear about it. And unfortunately, an awful lot of other people have chosen not to hear about it as well. So we're going to take a look at solid indications that, in fact, Ruby and Oswald knew each other, the Warren Commission's disclaimers to the contrary notwithstanding. We're also going to take a look, as well as looking at some of the hard, established evidence, we're going to take a look at some of the unpursued leads in the Kennedy assassination, areas that offer, as I like to say, food for thought and grounds for further research, not hard connections, but coincidences which frankly strain the intellect, if one is to, in fact, assume that these are coincidences. Now, again, I've done a lot of work on the Kennedy assassination, the Guns of November, parts 1 through 4, that I put together in November of 1983 on the 20th anniversary of Kennedy's assassination. Radio Free America shows 11, 12, 13, and 15. There are two archive shows, one a miscellaneous archive show dealing with the political implications of Kennedy's assassination, and the other a program called Edwin Walker, Lee Harvey Oswald, and the Fourth Reich. They can all be obtained from Archives on Audio. We're going to take a look at the death of someone, a homosexual in Dallas-Fort Worth area who was very close to Jack Ruby and who was also very close to the person who drove Lee Harvey Oswald to the Texas School Book Depository on 11-22-63 when he supposedly assassinated John Kennedy. Although this is not a hard connection, the very suspicious circumstances of this individual's death suggests that that is an area to be pursued. We're also going to be taking a look at another lead, something which is not a hard connection but which may prove to be very revealing. Namely, we're going to take a look at President Kennedy's plans, and they're quite well established historically, to replace Lyndon Johnson as vice president with Senator George Smathers of Florida. And it's worth noting that one of the suspicions that exists on the part of many researchers, and I share that, is that LBJ aide Bobby Baker, who became enmeshed in a variety of scandals in the 1960s, had learned of Kennedy's plans to replace LBJ, and his secretary, Carol Tyler, was a roommate of Smathers' secretary. Smathers' secretary was Mary Jo Kopechne, who died in under questionable circumstances in the Chappaquiddick incident, which seriously damaged the political career of the surviving Kennedy brother, namely Ted Kennedy. Carol Tyler herself was later killed in the crash of a private plane. Again, this is by way of food for thought and grounds for further research, but there are so many areas that have gone unexplored and which could help to reveal a great deal about the political life of the United States. Among the people who joined in the chorus pillorying the Stone movie and Jim Garrison was an NPR commentator named Cokie Roberts. She said that she did not plan on seeing the movie JFK because her father was a member of the Warren Commission. Well, indeed, her father was. Her father was Representative Hale Boggs of Louisiana, and he was one of the members of the Warren Commission who was a strong dissenter. He had serious doubts about the commission's procedures. Those doubts grew with time. He became a Warren Commission critic of sorts. And not all of the Warren commissioners went along with the official cover-up. Hale Boggs was one who consistently voiced skepticism. He would have become Speaker of the House. He was second in line to become Speaker of the House, but a Warren Commission member and eventual critic, Hale Boggs, disappeared on October 16, 1972. His private plane on a flight from Juneau to Anchorage, Alaska, vanished. A 39-day search by the Air Force and Navy failed to locate it, and it is tragic in an exemplary way, I suppose, that Cokie Roberts refuses to examine the truth concerning her father's assassination, or concerning Freudian slip, or Kennedy's assassination, because an examination of those facts would not only reveal that her father was skeptical of the Warren Commission, but that he himself may have fallen prey, I say may have fallen prey, to the ongoing program of political assassination, which has been implemented by elements of our national security establishment against any political leader or any citizen who threatens the political status quo. So we will take a look at what happened with Hale Boggs as our next item. We're going to take a musical break after that, and I'm going to take a look at some of the things that have gone on in connection with the rioting in Los Angeles, the appointment of former CIA Director William Webster to head up the investigation into the LAPD's curious handling of the Los Angeles riots. Also going to take a look at a National Guardsman who was caught in Beverly Hills with Molotov cocktail-making equipment, weapons, and shielded license plates. And also an account of a possible, I say possible, link between Fort Ord in Monterey and a guns for drugs deal, reportedly. Now, note the use of the term reportedly, involving some of the LA gang members. We're going to ruminate about that as well. Also going to take a look at a really terrifying column, which was run, well, I guess originally in the Chicago Tribune, but in this case in the San Jose Mercury News, by a fellow named Lars Eric Nelson. And he advocates, quite simply, sending in troops to police our inner cities. And that is something which I hope does not happen. But there are indications that we are moving in that direction, and we're going to have to be alerted to that. I'm also going to reread a section from an article that I read on the air last week dealing with Operation Gladio. That was a NATO contingency plan to set up guerrilla groups in Europe to harass the Red Army in the event of a Soviet invasion of Western Europe. Those contingency plans appear to have contributed massively to the setting up of political provocations, in particular in conjunction with fascist elements in various parts of Europe, including and especially Italy. And we're going to take a look at the ruminations of an Italian fascist, Vincenzo Vintigera, concerning the effect of the strategy of tension and how it worked in Italy, and by way of taking a look at some of the things that are going on in this country and what we may find ourselves in. We are in a situation where I think it is extremely dangerous to overlook the possibility that a strategy of tension could be employed in the United States. We're also going to touch back on someone that I've been very critical of in the past, and another darling of the progressive political sector, namely Jesse Jackson. I'm going to review some very questionable aspects of Jesse Jackson's behavior in connection with the assassination of Martin Luther King, whose mantle Jesse has assumed. I'm going to take a look, too, or review, I'm not going to read, but review some information from Radio Free America number 8 dealing with the assassination of Martin Luther King concerning Jesse Jackson's meeting with George Bush shortly after George Bush got elected, largely as a result of his racist campaign involving the Willie Horton ploy. George said that Jesse and I have worked together on many policy areas in the past and invited Jesse to disagree with him. Jesse did not disagree with him. And then they both agreed that James Earl Ray, the patsy who took the fall from the Martin Luther King assassination, should not be paroled. Well, Jesse's at it again in 1992, in 1988, among others. Former Texas Congresswoman Barbara Jordan charged that Jesse Jackson was deliberately sabotaging the campaign of Mike Dukakis because he resented not being offered the vice presidential spot. And Jesse Jackson is not doing Bill Clinton any good either in 1992. He's moderated his fierce attacks, but Jesse invited Bill Clinton to a forum in which a rap singer known as Sister Souljah had some rather inflammatory comments to make about the possibility of killing police. And had Bill Clinton not gone on the offensive against Sister Souljah, and I admire him for doing it, that would have opened him wide. I would have left him wide open to the attack dogs of the Republican Party, and we saw in 1988 what they can do. So we're going to take a look at Jesse and Sister Souljah and Bill Clinton and George Bush by way of seeing how George Bush and the master cynics of the Republican Party could have exploited Clinton's presence at this gathering had he not distanced himself from the inflammatory remarks of Sister Souljah. And those remarks, I think, should be examined against the background of the Los Angeles riots, and they could lead to a justification for the imposition of martial law in our inner cities, as Lars Eric Nelson has advocated. George Bush has criticized vocally a rap singer named Ice-T for a song that he had called Cop Killer, or maybe it's an album. At any rate, that song/album advocates the killing of police, at least to a certain extent, perhaps tongue-in-cheek, I don't know. This, by the way, should not be interpreted as an indictment of rap music per se, but rather watch how George Bush is manipulating this particular issue, and I think you'll see just how vulnerable Bill Clinton could have been had he not distanced himself from Sister Souljah. But let us let the counters fall where they may. George Bush is dumping all over Ice-T for the Cop Killer song/album. I do not agree with that sort of inflammatory lyric. I think it plays into the hands of people like George Bush. But interestingly enough, the aforementioned Ice-T had a movie release recently. It was called Ricochet. I did not see it. I don't go for movies like that. But Ricochet was released by Silver Screen Partners, or it was financed by Silver Screen Partners, a movie production company, one of whose directors is George Bush Jr. And that'll be the last item that we're going to touch on tonight. If George Bush Sr. does not like Ice-T, then perhaps he might talk to George Jr. and see if George Jr. would stop producing movies, helping to finance movies featuring Ice-T. A bit of hypocrisy, more hypocrisy on the part of our President George Herbert Walker Bush. So that's what we have on tap for this evening. I'm going to take a short musical break, and then we're going to come back with the main body of the prepared portion of tonight's program. Music, and then the prepared portion of our broadcast. Well, good evening. Welcome back once again to One Step Beyond. It's time now to begin the prepared portion of tonight's program. Now, again, this broadcast is going to be a little bit different from programs in the past. This is going to go into the archive shows as, I guess, I haven't decided what to title it, but perhaps Observations on the Nation's 216th Birthday, perhaps in parentheses, Dave Emery's Credo, because you're going to hear as close to my own Credo as I'm capable of playing for you on the air. Last night, with some friends, I was observing some fireworks from afar. In fact, I came up to Foothill College here and stood out on the hill and was watching several different fireworks displays. And as I was doing that, that's a strange sort of melancholy slash depression came over me. I was observing some families with children, and it struck me as strange and sort of tragic that here the country was observing its 216th birthday, and in fact, the country might very well have been observing its own wake. This country is in bad, bad, bad shape. Bad economically. We're the world's biggest debtor nation. We were the world's biggest creditor nation from the end of World War I through 1980. Ronald Reagan, who came in promising to hold down government spending and reduce the deficits, did the opposite. We used to have more money owed to us than any other nation on Earth. We now owe more money than any nation on Earth, more than all of the third world countries combined. The savings and loans have gone belly up, and the SNL bailout is going to cost more than the Second World War would have cost us had it been updated to 1992 dollars. There is enormous insecurity in the commercial banks. They may be next. The Office of Management and Budget has forecast that several might go under this year, and you and me, i.e. the taxpayers, are going to have to foot the bill for that one. There's enormous corporate debt because of the leverage buyouts and the go-go financing of the 1980s. There's enormous consumer debt. The insurance companies are in bad shape, and many of the money market funds are privately insured. The U.S. is losing its industrial base. Corporations are moving manufacturing facilities overseas at the cost of jobs to the United States in order to take advantage of the low labor costs, particularly in areas of the third world. There are enormous, enormous things being done to our legal system. The new improved Supreme Court and federal judiciary are doing some really scary, scary things. A recent Supreme Court decision made it legal to burn crosses, this under the rubric of freedom of expression, something I do not agree with. And even more significantly, there have been a number of decisions which have limited, court decisions which have limited the writ of habeas corpus. Lord Blackstone, generally viewed as the top scholar or authority on Anglo-Saxon law, wrote centuries ago that any limitation of the writ of habeas corpus represented a fundamental elimination of personal liberty as we understand it. Well, that's going on right now. The Supreme Court made a decision that a grand jury does not have to be shown information, evidence which would acquit someone facing the grand jury, that the person is going to have to go to trial in order to gain acquittal, even if the grand jury could demonstrate that the individual in question was innocent. That represents an enormous step. Under the drug seizure laws, a person's property can be confiscated if the authorities, i.e. the police, suspect the individual of being a drug dealer. Now, that is a remarkable situation. Not 80% of the people that have had their property confiscated have not even been accused of crimes. I don't mean convicted. They were never even accused of crimes. And then the individual whose property has been seized has to sue the government in order to get it back. The rules of evidence in a civil case are much looser than in a criminal case. And beyond that, if you've had all your property seized, how the hell are you going to sue? You got no money. That is a staggering legal precedent, or perhaps illegal precedent would be a better term under the circumstances, and it's one which threatens all of us. Basically, if the authorities could say that they suspect you of anything, terrorism or subversive activity, and confiscate your property, it represents a serious step down the road to fascism, and that is a direction that I feel the United States has been headed in for a long, long time. The feelings that I had upon watching the fireworks, again, were feelings of melancholy. I felt particularly sorry for some of the children who were enjoying the fireworks display as much as I used to when I was a child. Those poor kids don't face much of a future unless all of us start pulling together and correcting the awfully grave situation that we face. One of the things that enabled people in Nazi Germany to remain idle while their country was hurtling down towards fascism was that basically people went along with the program. They conformed. Nobody wanted to appear to be out of step with his or her companions, and ultimately that conformity led to all of the monstrous excesses of the Third Reich. And one of the things that I think has bedeviled the United States, and I mean to use the term bedeviled quite literally, is the fact that Americans are going along with the program. People are doing what their neighbors do, doing what their compatriots do, keeping up with the Joneses, so to speak. Well, all that's going to be required in this country for people to find themselves in the midst of total king hell fascism is for people to keep up with the Joneses, because the only Jones they're going to wind up keeping up with is the late Reverend Jim of the People's Temple. And as I've looked at in numerous Radio Free America shows, including Radio Free America 6 and 7, there are substantive indications that the People's Temple was a CIA operation. I'm going to reread, because I've read it periodically over the years, a section from a book called They Thought They Were Free, subtitled The Germans, 1933 to 1945. The book was authored by Milton Mayer, M-A-Y-E-R, published in softcover, I should say, by the University of Chicago Press, and copyrighted 1955. What Mayer is writing about is the observations of a number of Germans who lived during the rise of Hitler. Some of them were ardent pro-Nazis, some of them were opposed to Hitler, but they stood by, they conformed, and they did nothing. And that's what resulted in the rise of German fascism. I'm going to reread just a section of this particular portion of the book. It's called But Then It Was Too Late. These are the observations of a German college professor on what it was like to experience the rise of the Third Reich. I'm not going to read the whole section that I usually read, but just a section of it. And one of the things that's important to take note of here is the role of conformity in the rise of fascism. Reading now from They Thought They Were Free. And again, this is a German college professor speaking here. You see, my colleague went on, one doesn't see exactly where or how to move. Believe me, this is true. Each act, each occasion is worse than the last, but only a little worse. You wait for the next and the next. You wait for one great shocking occasion, thinking that others, when such a shock comes, will join with you in resisting somehow. You don't want to act or even talk alone. You don't want to, quote, go out of your way to make trouble, unquote. Why not? Well, you are not in the habit of doing it. And it is not just fear of standing alone that restrains you. It is also genuine uncertainty. Uncertainty is a very important factor, and instead of decreasing as time goes on, it grows. Outside, in the streets, in the general community, quote, everyone, unquote, is happy. One hears no protest and certainly sees none. You know, in France or Italy, there would be slogans against the government painted on walls and fences. In Germany, outside the great cities, perhaps there is not even this. In the university community, in your own community, you speak privately to your colleagues, some of whom certainly feel as you do. But what do they say? They say, it's not so bad, or you're seeing things, or you're an alarmist. And you are an alarmist. You are saying that this must lead to this, and you can't prove it. These are the beginnings, yes, but how do you know for sure when you don't know the end? And how do you know or even surmise the end? On the one hand, your enemies, the law, the regime, the party, intimidate you. On the other, your colleagues poo-poo you as pessimistic or even neurotic. You are left with your close friends who are naturally people who have always thought as you have. But your friends are fewer now. Some have drifted off somewhere or submerged themselves in their work. You no longer see as many as you did at meetings or gatherings. Informal groups become smaller, attendance drops off in little organizations, and the organizations themselves wither. Now, in small gatherings of your oldest friends, you feel that you are talking to yourselves, that you are isolated from the reality of things. This weakens your confidence still further and serves as a further deterrent to what? It is clear all the time that if you are going to do anything, you must make an occasion to do it, and then you are obviously a troublemaker. So you wait, and you wait. But the one great shocking occasion when tens or hundreds or thousands will join with you never comes. That's the difficulty. If the last and worst act of the whole regime had come immediately after the first and smallest, thousands, yes, millions, would have been sufficiently shocked if, let us say, the gassing of the Jews in 43 had come immediately after the German firm stickers on the windows of non-Jewish shops in 33. But, of course, this isn't the way it happens. In between come all the hundreds of little steps, some of them imperceptible, each of them preparing you not to be shocked by the next. Step C is not so much worse than step B, and if you did not make a stand at step B, why should you at step C? And so on to step D. And one day, too late, your principles, if you were ever sensible of them, all rush in upon you. The burden of self-deception has grown too heavy, and some minor incident, in my case, my little boy, hardly more than a baby, saying, "Juice wine," collapses it all at once, and you see that everything has changed and changed completely under your nose. The world you live in, your nation, your people, is not the world you were born in at all. The forms are all there, all untouched, all reassuring. The houses, the shops, the jobs, the meal times, the visits, the concerts, the cinema, the holidays. But the spirit, which you never noticed because you made the lifelong mistake of identifying it with the forms, is changed. Now you live in a world of hate and fear, and the people who hate and fear do not even know it themselves. When everyone is transformed, no one is transformed. Now you live in a system that rules without responsibility even to God. The system itself could not have intended this in the beginning, but in order to sustain itself, it was compelled to go all the way. You have gone almost all the way yourself. Life is a continuing process, a flow, not a succession of acts and events at all. It has flowed to a new level, carrying you with it without any effort on your part. On this new level you live, you have been living more comfortably every day with new morals and new principles. You have accepted things that you would not have accepted 5 years ago, a year ago, things that your father, even in Germany, could not have imagined. Suddenly it all comes down, all at once. You see what you are, what you have done, or more accurately, what you haven't done. For that was all that was required of most of us, that we do nothing. Well, indeed, that is all that is going to be required of most people to allow the things that are overtaking this country now to continue, and that is to go along with the program, keep up with your neighbors, conform, don't protest. After all, things are basically, on the surface at least, they appear the same if you can ignore all the homeless people and other obvious signs of social disintegration. But the forms are all there, all reassuring. And one of the things that the Nazis used very effectively was the human inclination to conform. One of the things that made it easy for them to round up entire ghetto areas of Jews and ship them to the concentration camps was that they rounded up the entire neighborhood at once. And people who had spent their entire lives keeping up with the Joneses, so to speak, doing what their neighbors did, doing what their compatriots did, simply went along. Everybody was going on the train, so they went too. And it's also worth noting that in areas, the Jewish areas of cities, the social conditions were allowed to deteriorate to an enormous extent. There was starvation, there was typhus. The situation got so bad that many of the ultimate victims of the Holocaust said to themselves, well, you know, when they were told that they were being relocated, perhaps to an area in the Ukraine or someplace else, they said, well, what could be worse than this? So they got on the trains. Well, they found out soon enough. But the conformity is an absolutely deadly thing in the face of fascism. And ultimately, those of us here in the United States are going to have to stop conforming, even though things may look okay on the surface. All the forms are there, all very reassuring. The houses, the cinemas. I personally don't like the summertime. This country is silly enough from September through May, but June, July, and August, this country gets really, really out to lunch. There's an enormous amount of silly power loose in the United States during the summertime, and this summer is no exception. People who perhaps weren't all that serious all year round begin paying attention to recreational activities exclusively. Certainly it's nice to enjoy the outdoors, everyone needs a vacation, but things get seriously stupid in the United States during the summertime, and they're stupid enough all year round. We've got all the jive movies, you know, Batman Part 6, or Nightmare on Elm Street Part 27, Freddy Does It in the Road, and people really go out to lunch from June through the end of August. It is my fear that if George Bush counters his very, very sorry position in the polls by precipitating an incident which could result in a partial or complete martial law. It will happen in the summertime when everybody is out to lunch. And it is time, I think, for those of us who take our lives in this country seriously to stop conforming, to stop going along with the Joneses, because, as I said, the only Jones you're going to wind up keeping up with is the late Reverend Jim of the People's Temple. One of my personal role models, an individual who I admire a great deal, both as an artist, as a human being, and also as a political animal, was the very famous playwright George Bernard Shaw. I would note, incidentally, that George Bernard Shaw was very active as an anti-fascist, one of the very first critics of the Mussolini regime in Italy. And his is an example that I think we could all profit by. As I mentioned at the top of the broadcast, when people ask me to characterize myself politically, I refer to myself as an anti-fascist. The vast majority of my political views would be seen as, you know, liberal slash progressive. Some of them, such as my opposition to gun control or my support for the POW-MIA situation with Harry Martin, would be seen as traditionally conservative, although actually if you took a look at the CIA connection to gun-to-gun control movement, the contingency plans to establish martial law, and if you took a look at the apparent involvement of some covert operators in Southeast Asia in the drug traffic there, and it was, as we have seen with the Kerry Subcommittee's report, covert operations specialists were left behind in Vietnam and Laos and Cambodia, and the government has deceived with this regard. So actually, I think if one were to examine my political views, they would all be seen as progressive, but I take a lot of heat from both the right and the left. I have tremendous admiration for the struggle put up by the Soviet Union and the various partisan movements, such as the partisan movement in Yugoslavia. I have tremendous admiration for their resistance to fascism. That gets me in a lot of trouble with more conservative listeners. On the other hand, I've always viewed Marxism as unworkable. It is a 19th century idealist system, and like all idealist systems, whether it's supply-side economics or Marxism, it was destined always, in my opinion, to fail. That alienates a lot of people on the left. The listenership to this program goes from the far left to the far right. Organizations like the Revolutionary Communist Party on the left to the John Birch Society on the right all tune in, and I don't take any truck with either of those two extremes, but they all tune in. I guess, to me at least, that's a certain amount of vindication for the hard documentary format that I use here. People want information, and they will get it, they know, on this program. The constructions that the right and left put on what I have to say, the far right and far left, of course, differ, but they all tune in. But I take a lot of heat from people who are doctrinaire of the right or left, because I am not an ideologue. I have always seen political ideology as a secularized form of religious dogma, and there is nothing more inimical to human understanding, in my opinion, than religious dogma. And that is not something which a lot of people are willing to give up. There are an awful lot of ideologues around, and again, I take a lot of heat from the right or the left, right and the left, I should say. Harry Martin, who I think is arguably the most important journalist in this country right now, is a political conservative. We disagree strongly about many, many things, but we agree about the rule of law and about the need for constitutional authority. Plus, Harry has some excellent contacts within the national security establishment and is quite obviously working with elements that are opposed to George Bush and some of the martial law plans that are going down right now. But I take a lot of heat over my alliance with Harry Martin, and Harry Martin, in turn, catches a lot of heat about his alliance with me. He works in Napa, the driving force behind the Napa Sentinel. Napa is an extremely reactionary community. Harry is now running for Napa County Supervisor, and he's being called a card-carrying leftist liberal because of his criticisms of the national security establishment. So if you're going to be a free thinker, if you're going to do what you feel is right, then you are going to catch a lot of hell from the ideologues of both the right and the left. But I feel it's essential for people to break the pattern of conformity if they are going to stem the rush toward fascism, which is going on in this country. As I said, one of my role models has long been George Bernard Shaw, an anti-fascist as well as a great artist. George Bernard Shaw had an interesting observation. He said that reasonable people adapt themselves to the world. Unreasonable people attempt to adapt the world to themselves. All progress, therefore, depends on unreasonable people. Well, I think that is an accurate statement, and an awful lot of us, I think, are going to have to become unreasonable people in the not-too-distant future if we are going to survive. And by way of underscoring George Bernard Shaw's political philosophy, a very important political philosophy. I'm going to play a section of a tape. I played this a few years ago, and I think there are some very, very profound insights into political, social, and intellectual reality.